Hello, in this podcast, I'm going to talk about the discovery of the most unlikely molecule. It's probably the smallest bond length, but it's also extremely unlikely. And I'm also going to tell you the unlikely sequence of events which led up to it. The molecule in question is helium-2, so it's two helium atoms, plus, so it's missing an electron, C2... pi G state. It's a particular molecule made at an energetic state of helium. And it's a very unlikely molecule when you come to discuss it. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. And if you've heard my previous podcasts, I'm in the throes of cardiac rehabilitation and honing my podcasting skills. Now, over the time, I realise that as I'm discussing things scientific ideas, it's best to actually bind it with a story. And so you can listen to a little bit of the story, a little bit of the science, follow the story, perhaps not the science, go back and look at the science. But in this case, we're going to start off with the science. Helium, everyone thinks of as an inert gas. That is, it doesn't bind with anything. It gets made in the centre of the Earth as the uranium in the centre of the Earth decays, generates heat. It's the waste product of uranium is the helium, and that helium slowly percolates its way through the rock, forming little bodies, I think, in Texas and in Africa. And people mine these fantastic bodies of helium and or gas reserves of helium, and goes around making our party balloons. We are really living helium as a party. It's a limited resource. It's been made by this very slow process. So it's also been made in the sun. Helium is the means helios, gas of the sun, and it was first discovered when people looked up at the sun and saw a mysterious fingerprint on the glowing surface layer of the sun. So outside the hot layer that you can see is another layer called the chromosphere. And this is a more tenuous high-temperature gas which is glowing in spectral lines and gives a series of dark... Well, you can see some dark lines as helium in this area absorbs light, and some bright lines if this is energized. So we can see this fingerprint which gave this mystery gas. We've got a mystery gas that's in the sun, but not on Earth. But eventually they found supplies of it in Earth, and we have them in party balloons. So helium, it's very hard to excite, but if you do hit it hard enough, you will create excited helium. And that excited helium is sort of like if helium itself was inert and very happy, this excited helium, its electrons really high up, excited, and it's orbiting at, orbiting at a greater distance, or its orbital is popped out. It's like popping corn. It's popped out, expanded, and it's not that far for it to actually be a party animal. It can actually emit light, or it can be further ionized, or it can actually do a whole lot of social things. So if you thought of helium as a wallflower standalone, helium, if you energize helium and make a metastable helium, or an excited state of helium, that is with the electron in a slightly higher orbital, it changes from the least reactive to the most reactive. It's so reactive that it actually binds with other heliums. So I'm going to tell you the story of how I first came across one of these lamps. So, obviously, you get a gas bottle of helium, put it through a glass tube, have two electrodes either side, and you run electricity through it to make it hot. And you look down the axis of this hot tube, if you do it correctly, and actually you can observe the light coming from it. Quite an interesting thing to do. So this is sort of fundamentally the setup of a laser. So a helium an old style, lovely iron atomic iron laser, atomic like a helium neon laser. The lasing doesn't come from the side of the tube. Like if you have a neon tube in your bathroom, it's a bar tube. The light comes off the side. The laser actually happens down the guts of the tube, and so this is where you get the light of it. And the story begins in my third year of university, and my first encounter with a helium lamp is going to be in South Australia, some 700 kilometres away, some 12 months ahead of this time. It's my 21st birthday. And a few years before my father's died, there's sort of no money and no will to have a 21st birthday. And the prospect of just sitting around Melbourne on the university break, having a 21st birthday with no one there, I thought, no, look, I'm going to get to South Australia to meet up my best friend, my best childhood friend, Martin Palmer. That's his name, in South Australia, and I have no contacts there, but I'm going to go to South Australia for my 25th birthday, so I'm in Melbourne. So if you've got a map of Australia, you've got Melbourne in Victoria, South Australia, you've got Adelaide, and this, you can draw a sort of a straight line across, it's around 780 kilometres, I sort of know that, and so I got with my friend and said, look, we've got no money, the only way we can get there is we're going to cycle there. So I did have a push bike and a little bit of money and a sleeping bag and some guts, and so we set off, and on over 4 days we cycled. We caught a train down to Geelong and cycled along the Great Ocean Road, so this beautiful eroded coast in Victoria with these beautiful things. We stopped in at friends' farms in the middle of a mouse plague, so there were mice everywhere, and we continued along. I remember there's a sort of a mountain range on the coast called the Otways, and there was storms the entire time. We were soaked all the way cycling, and these are just street bikes. They're nothing, not special, some special mountain bikes we've got today. This is 86. Cycling from Melbourne to Adelaide. And this is a year, full year ahead of it. And I grew up in South Australia, and South Australia that I grew up was a much more country place, a much more friendly place than the big city of Melbourne that I grew up in. One of the things I do remember is cycling up to the top of Otway, and there was a little. There's stores, but and you really rely on these stores to buy provisions or stuff as you go along, some sort of high sugary stuff. But I do remember cycling down the other side of the Otways and at a very high speed, and at the end was a wooden bridge. And the thing is that there were wooden slats, possibly a few centimetres, about 20 centimetres wide, which go right across the bridge, and then gaps either side, tyre gaps either side. Of course, we came streaming down here, and it was just close your eyes, and miraculously I rode across this bridge. It must have been possibly 30 metres more long at high speed, in the wet, without going off to either side. It was probably certain death at the other side. I suppose other memories there is that towards the last Victoria was a place called Dartmoor with a creek on it, and we put our tent, a little kutchies down by the... Oh, there's lots of stories there. That was completely chock-a-block of mosquitoes, and then we just went up to the nearest house and said, please, we've got to go inside, and they had a caravan there for us, so we were able to do it there. And then the winds going up through South Australia, the winds are pointing the opposite direction. People who said they're saying, no, there's only one way, you cycle from Adelaide to Melbourne, because you've got this huge headwind. So there's these huge headwinds as we cycled through South Australia, eventually to Adelaide. And the story is that I... met my old school friends. I hadn't been to South Australia for 15 years. Met my old school friends and had the unfortunate news that my best friend had died in a car accident. Oh, my God, that's dreadful news. Then I was at someone else's party there. So the sort of thing that you can do, you can just turn up in your cycle gear with your bike in the middle of nowhere, and you're sort of instantly back in your group of friends who you haven't spoken to for 15 years, and you picked up the various pieces of things. And they said, oh, look, I've got to leave. I've got to go to Marty Palmer's 21st birthday. I said, what? And so we arrived, guest of honours, unannounced as the old childhood friends. So it all went really well. We left, cycled away the next night. The next day, I cycled up to his house. So this is an Adelaide. These are fair 15-kilometre cycles back through Adelaide. Adelaide's relatively flat. There's hills that you have to get through, which are just gruesome at the end. They're not big hills, but they're up and down, especially if you're cycling. And it's dreadful going down there. His best friend was a bit tipsy and died on the way, dropped a friend, and then was driving back and slammed into a tree and died. So that sort of knocked the party spirit off. And again, I didn't speak to Marty Palmer again after that, so I saw him briefly for the 21st birthday. And he was a special friend because I couldn't speak in an intelligible way until I was, a bit north of 8 years old. So I'd speak in this sort of garbled way that only Marty Palmer, my best friend, understood. So he would, in grade one and grade two, be a steadfast translator for me. So I would speak, and the teacher would say, what is he saying? And he would translate, and he'd generally get it spot on. So I don't know how that worked. So we were very good. I was a very good friend of him. He obviously sort of developed in the South Australian view, a sporting person. I was more an academic person. So I had my taste of South Australia. And then at the end of my honours years, I was going through Melbourne University. I had ground through a year of I did atomic and molecular physics, and I did molecular beams. And I must admit, we had no idea about quantum mechanics back in Melbourne University. We still had the idea that it was just the all little particles flying around the place. And we had these things which scratched your head in terms of, I began to study transitions where the electrons actually tunneled through the nucleus and stuff like that. So what I'm doing is giving you a background history of a life story and some more personal details, some more gutsy way. And again, in this, to help me through university, and namely to get me fed for a couple of weeks, I was in Army Reserve, and so they sort of gave you confidence in maps and just setting up a tent and existing long term and looking after yourself. So that's our journey off to from Melbourne to Adelaide, 4 days of cycling. I'm sure people who are fitter or have better bikes can do that in no time whatsoever, but that was a real struggle. The next year, an honours year. There was general interest. I began to pick up general relativity. I worked on a molecular beam, I worked with a professor, Opat, who, it turned out, had been very good friends with my father when he was at Melbourne University running Australia's fourth computer back there in the early 50s to 60s. So but we didn't know this at the time, so I was very good friends with this professor, and we spent lots of hours just talking through about what is happening with these molecules, how these molecules can work, because I was working with a beam of water, an elaborate water pistol, which went through 3 meters of vacuum system, and it would freeze coming out of a molecular beam. So you know how freezers work. So if you actually just get normal water and squirt it, it actually freezes. So the basic effect, say if you've got spray on deodorant or something like that, the bottle can feel cold and the actual jet freezes, and you can use this freezing property to actually freeze your beam in flight. And it can be so cold, theoretically, you could use it to diffract and measure gravity waves. So there's a whole lot of interest there. And at the end of the year, again, I had army camps, and not a lot happening. I was applying for a Commonwealth scholarship. So you could have two grades of scholarships. You could have a university scholarship, or if your grades were good enough, at the end of honours, you could get a Commonwealth scholarship. So I put in, and eventually I got the slightly higher, more flexible Commonwealth scholarship. So a scholarship is money which you have, and you can actually select the university that you want. You can go around and select it. I think it had a very meagre $8,000 a year or something like that. So what had happened previously, there was free education, and it's the process of moving away from free education, and the government had a very anti-PhD policy, and what that had happened, fortunately, it meant that I had any university I wanted to select, because it had turned so many people off doing PhDs. And in molecular physics, very hard. But Adelaide University had come for $80 a week. You can work this is basically called a scholarship, $80 a week. You can work with us in the molecular physics. And so not many options left. Again, got on my bike again. This time I said I'll cut a bit off. I'm sure, actually, the first time we did over 1,000 kilometres, this time I did a straight cycle. And this time I cycled straight north out of Melbourne to Ballarat, Ararat, and still eventually hit South Australia. So South Australia is a very windy place, and I cycled across, and I'm going down to Adelaide University. So you come out of the hills of Adelaide University, there's a sort of, I think there's a diagonal road which goes straight into Adelaide, and you wind up at Adelaide University. And I arrived at, I think, after lunch, because it was a bit delayed, and they said, oh, how did you get here? On my bike from Melbourne. And it's sort of a general lay of the land. And I think it was on Friday afternoon or something like that. And, of course, there was a delay of several weeks before I'd get my paid. So there was a steep thing. And I found the local caravan park, and had to pay just for a tent site, and slept out there underneath the hutchie, and got a hutchie is the Australian name for a piece of plastic, sort of weatherproof ground sheet that you hook up and you sleep under. What had happened is Adelaide was the hotbed of the United States Air Force rocket program. They would have the rockets being launched from Woomera, US satellites. Australia launched a satellite, and we'd launch these packets up, and so there's a very large United States Air Force spectrometer there. When I say a large one, this is imagine a tube of garbage trucks just going past. Imagine two garbage trucks end on end, and a vacuum that evacuated the air pulled out of that space. You've got huge vacuum pumps pulling it out, and I think it was an 8-metre Eagle Mount spectrometer. They had that there at one point, and they had rocket bits and heaps of special rocket grade aluminium around the place to machine bits and pieces, and spectrometers. They had this fantastic UV research lab, and it was of these rather old spectrometers, and there'd be a spectrometer there, and underneath it would be a pit with the vacuum pumps for it. And so we're almost going up. I'm just giving you a bit of description coming along. And so into this, I did a developed a double iron chamber. Unfortunately, I had this is a method that was my job to develop a along the lines a method of measuring gas cross section, how much a UV when UV hits some gas, what rate does it ionize it, what rate does it absorb, and I was able to use some advanced maths concept to actually just redesign one of these, and I had my first second publication out on that, so you can look that up if you want to. Peter Colin Hill, interpretation of the outputs of a double iron chamber. There's a story to that, but so it just meant that with the maths on that, I finished that my summer project very quickly, and then I got the various $80 over the various weeks, and then saying, "Oh look, it's time for you to make a decision to do a PhD." And so eventually, I began doing a PhD. This story is after sitting there for a while, I decided to move from Adelaide to ANU because they were a bit better funded and organised, and I had an aim to get my PhD done very quickly. So, also up to this, besides learning training from the Army, I had come across project management and critical path programming. So while I was doing my PhD, you would go around to the mechanical engineering department and get trained on how to do this sort of stuff. And there goes my PhD. There's a few papers involved in that. One of the things is that there was a UV lab. So they've produced not your standard UV party lights. This is UV light produced by the sun. And, yeah, produced by the sun, it doesn't reach Earth. This is extreme UV. And it just as soon as it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it creates atoms everywhere. And so they had a special light producing the hot field continuum. This is our first introduction to helium. And it's got a thyristor, which is a sort of out of the 1930s movies, this sort of large, like a coffee pot with electrodes in it, and it heats up and hots and it oscillates at high frequency. And it was used in radar produce high frequency pulses, so it's really out of World War II. This type of stuff, and a thyristor is a high speed oscillator producing radio frequencies, and so you had to pump this with specially wound transformers and put it in a bird cage or a wire cage because it was producing huge radio pulses, and so if you had that in the lab, it would just basically fry everything else. So you had a thyristor, one of these things, and you'd put it up against into a what's like a distillation tube with electrodes in it, and get some helium going through and water on the outside to cool it down, and this would oscillate at high speed, and this would produce something called a helium dimer. So if you heat up helium, ionize it, flash it, ionize it, it produces helium plus a whole heap of metastable helium. So this is one of the things to get your mind around, that you can for something to radiate, it has to change the electrons has to change shape to its ground state through a certain symmetry. If the symmetry or the orientation of this shape is incorrect, it could get down there, but it's got to actually get down there and flip or flick. It's actually flick out the light. It's called a dipole transition moment. So with helium, helium is beautifully circularly symmetric, and the first excited state of helium, so helium's 1s, so its electrons beautiful Gaussian spheres. Okay, one of the things you're going to have to let go of is the electron's a little spot and it's coming in. It's the actual electron is a pure Gaussian sphere. And when you heat it up, you can excite it, yes, by hitting it really hard, and then it will oscillate to the next state above it, which is another Gaussian sphere with a sort of a node inside the 2s, the 2s state. So you can have 2s1 and 2s2 state. The problem is that that Gaussian sphere can't flick, can't get that dipole transmission moment to actually flick out light. So you get a large amount of this energized helium. So the electricity goes into the helium, and the helium stays around as this metastable state. Now this is used in a helium neon laser. These metastable things then go bump against a neon and create an excited state and create a population inversion, create your laser. That's helium neon. The helium is just there as a battery source, atomic size battery source to pump your layer. But this metastable stuff at a certain pressure will go to normal helium and actually bind with helium, produce a molecule, and this molecule is attractive. There's the electrons, so you've got here four electrons, and overall there's three binding and one antibinding, and they come together and forms a molecule. And this molecule has got a new symmetry. It's allowed to actually transition, and it will transition to an antibinding. Ground state of helium is not binding. It will transition, releasing light and releasing it as a continuum. So this produces, this type of helium produces a continuum. I'm just trying to actually get, 800 angstroms, 80 nanometers, there you go, 80 nanometers around there is the hot field continuum. It's got a lump because it's got a one Gaussian lump and a second lump because there's two pathways out there. That's a beautiful continuum of light, and you do need a continuum of light so you can actually get a diffraction grading and select out any wavelength that you want, so you can actually use this as a tunable stuff and pick up sweet spots in atoms at the other end. So this is a light source. The light source goes into your monochromator, which selects out a wavelength. Now, that's the old way of doing it. The new way of doing it is that we get two lasers and mix the lasers together to make UV light. I don't know how effective this is. I think this is quite an economical way of doing it. So you've got this light source, and of course you can't see any of the UV, and so this has got a sort of a reddy colour, and and the entire idea of this is of dimers is they are molecules. You've got to get the gas temperature relatively low, so this is why it's pulsed, a quick pulse, you create it, don't heat up the gas too much, and you get these molecules produced, and gives you this pink colour, and that's your helium molecule being produced. And so as you increase the gas temperature, the gas pressure above, I think it is, I don't know whether it's 20 or 80, I can't quite remember, torr or millimetres of mercury, so it's a vacuum system and you just turn your gas bottle up, the gas colour changes from pink to peach colour, this sort of yellowy colour to it, a different colour, and the actual diffusion of the light goes into a central channel, and it sort of sounds the same. There's this buzzing sound. I don't know why there's a buzzing sound, you hear it, and at this the continuum disappears, but you can pick up all sorts of other light except in that area. And I looked it up and I said, this is a mystery. We don't know what the source of this is. It's probably helium 2+. That is a helium ion and a metastable ion coming together to make a helium molecule. And that for me, I had this aha moment. I really want to understand that. I want to understand that. And that really pushed my understanding. I wanted to understand it. And so push came to shove. I moved from Adelaide University to Canberra University. Bear in mind that that took about a year or 9 months to make the transition. And within 2.5 years, I was getting ready to submit my PhD. So I had sort of read management, how to do things, producing papers and stuff like that. And I said, look, you've got a spare monochromator there, vacuum monochromator there. I'd like to actually look at helium to these supervisors who were, I realised later, and I realised students before and after me had an idea of PhD student equals free labour for a number of years, so we were off on different tangents, and I said, look, I want to produce this helium and have a look at it and produce it. And they said, no, you can't. So this is a true story. I at night would drag capacitor off the old. We had a huge storeroom behind ANU. ANU's on the coast of Lake Burley Griffin, and they had old capacitors back from Mark Oliphant's anti-proton days. This is just amazing super physics. And they had these capacitors, which I now realise are pretty lethal. And there's things you do, they have memory on them, so you have to discharge. These capacitors you would charge up, and they charge up to a voltage, and there's basically no circuitry behind these helium flash lamps. And the idea is you crank the pressure up, you crank the voltage up, you let it go, and you've got this molecule produced. And at this stage, I'd come at night, in the night, quickly put it together, get a spectrum, and then take it apart again, and just get a few spectrum like that. And with that spectrum of it, this is the amount of light in the red. Physically, it was a visible spectrum, but went way out into the ultraviolet. Under different conditions, I went along and began to truly try and nut out what was going on. And fortunately, and this is a little bit of a story, ANU had developed, had its own supercomputers. So back in the late 80s, a supercomputer would read as sort of like a company's now basic set of desktop PCs put together. Look, there's more to it. They could do basically the languages massively parallel. And I began speaking to someone, and we began to actually crack apart the molecular potentials for that's the energy curves for various helium combinations to work through what it was. And there's not a lot of stress here, so you've got the helium plus helium. Helium 2 plus is bound in its ground state, so there's bound state there. Then there's an unbound state, and the very first state is the C2 pi U state. And it's got a 1 EV energy barrier against it, all these crazy things about it. And I think we only had enough spare time to use 5 molecular orbitals and put them into this program called Gaussian to work out these molecular potentials. Now, fortunately, now there's a little bit of a story there for ANU. ANU, my father had organised in the 60s the CSIRO computers, and he bought a series of 3,600 computers for each state, and he was going to well, they were all linked up to each other. They could all speak to each other by telephone. I don't know if this is going to upset people. And he had got the 3200 as a server. Now, all these things were not understood, and the political people at the time said, look, we don't understand all of this. We're going to take 3200 control data, CDC, I suppose. This is just out of my memory. And we're going to give it to ANU to use it because this server idea is stupid. And so, well, ANU, very early on, sort of from nowhere, got a CSIRO 3200. Now, I only know this from private chats with a professor I became good friends with afterwards, after all this episode. And so they began the computing tradition at ANU, which meant that by the time I arrived there, they had evolved to a Fujitsu supercomputer and were able to do the calculations of these curves, because they were, at that time they weren't available in the literature. Another aspect is that my father, who was the first computer programmer, first computer science, had taught me how to invert matrices, the process of inverting matrices. You can imagine a 12-year-old kid being taught how to invert matrices. So I knew how to do this, and I was able to run from scratch, read papers, and convert, sort of work out what the potentials were in, or the orbitals were in, these things produced by the supercomputer, and actually produce spectra out the other end, and actually run a closed loop. I had my spectra and was able to see how good or what adjustments were to the orbits. So the orbital, if you just put in the orbital and put in the maths directly into your computer, you'd get a spectrum, and that would equal exactly the other spectrum that you had. And you'd put things to do with, you could put temperature in to get two or three levels. I think this only supported two levels. And I was able to crank that through and produce a paper on that. There was still a whole heap of mystery. The mystery was that the spectra out under certain conditions looks like a black body radiation spectrum, and that's just nature for you. And you had the problem of how the heck was, with thermal equilibrium, was a molecule being produced at around 10,000 degrees Kelvin. These were issues that couldn't be solved, and therefore in the conservative bright spark coming up with an idea, I can think of reasons it can't go, so look, no go. But sort of back then I was young, it really didn't matter. Let's talk again about a helium molecule. Now, the surprising thing is that the helium molecule was not He2 or He2 star or He2 plus, but He2 plus was discussed and calculated in 1931. This is, get it, 5 years after the discovery of quantum mechanics. People were beginning to calculate why hydrogen is bound. So hydrogen is bound very simply because it's got two protons and two electrons, and the two electrons spin up, spin down, are split into a molecular orbital, which is a binding orbital. So the both electrons bind and form a bond. And by taking just basic maths, these geniuses able to get the atomic hydrogen molecular level. And then, sort of almost mind-blowingly, this Linus Pauling said, well, look, also, helium-2 double plus is bound. So that's a helium molecule, but you've added a proton in each of those hydrogens. It's a helium molecule. And he said, well, this is going to be the smallest smallest bond length possible. And he calculated it out. And intuitively, this is really hard to believe, that two electrons can be good enough to actually stick four protons together, four plus charge. It's just impossible to understand. Now, what in actual fact happens when you go through the maths? I must admit, I can't fully follow the way that Linus Pauling in 1931 did it. There's a region in which it's repulsive, but in that repulsive curve, there's a little divot of stability due to attraction. And he calculated it, and this is officially the smallest molecule possible. It's not a stable molecule, but you can actually make it. And I don't know whether there's too much recording of it, because it's, how do you actually observe that you've made it? This is relevant because what I was discovering is that I was creating a molecule with a 1.4 EV activation energy that's repulsive, and it had this zone of stability. It was just like helium 2 double plus, just bound in the bottom area. So basically helium 2 is not bound because it's two binding and two anti-binding orbitals, so it just falls apart. If you take away the two electrons, you can actually make it small bound. So there's an understanding here. Of course, what I was producing is a helium 2 plus with three binding electrons. The electron was at an excited energy level, which contributed at some way to the binding of it. So this is how I was producing it. But the problem was that this lamp was extraordinarily efficient. There was basically no other atomic lines, there was nothing happening, but this was the major thing that was happening. I began to sort of publish, this is what it is, but we don't know. This is in Fizeriff A. We don't know where it's from. I suppose that the story at this stage is I suppose the ability to actually research on sheer belief and be a bit disconnected from the institutional barriers or institutional supports there. It sort of meant that I developed this, and so I sort of really wasn't referencing myself to the institutional supports. If I did, I think I would have given up fairly quickly. I did actually make some really good sort of friends, sort of elder statesman friends, scientists at ANU, mainly Professor Ian Ross, who's a great friend, who sort of used to laugh at enjoy my enthusiasm. And so looking at it, was forming, it was basically an arc. So essentially, while people in dimer science were producing a very finessed laser system, and I began eventually in Canada to work on these finessed laser systems where you just pre-ionize and you just pop in the energy just a little bit before, and it's not still nice and cold, and the cold molecules lays, and this is your excimer laser, these beautiful beasts called excimer lasers. This was a dinky dye Star Wars phasal arc, a small little tube producing heaps and buckets of light, and a very, very, very bright flash lamp. And so my reading of this, and bear in mind I was just beginning to understand things, was this would form a laser. But let's go back a step. One of the things from the ANU supercomputer is that they produce electron density maps. And I thought, aha. So bear in mind that there's a coal train coming through. This will be a fairly loud thing for a while. Bear in mind that I had been of the belief system that it's quantum mechanics, which I understood, but the actual real world was these tiny spot flies, like flies over barbecue. You've got your chop, and then the electrons are sort of like flies which fly around between your two chops, or two bangers, or whatever, two meatballs. Your two meatballs and flies are flying around. That was my belief. And I had the computer printout of the electron density maps for the different orbitals, these orbitals. And I remember at ANU laser physics tea room, the sunlight streaming in as I looked through these electron maps and realised the electron is not at a particular point. It's actually big and diffused. And I had that aha moment, which actually set me on the path of a deeper understanding of quantum mechanics. And then as I looked, I realised that things which are lighter are more diffuse than quantum mechanics. And of course, if you're dealing with molecular transitions, you're not running a huge experiment. Things don't collapse. Their molecular dynamics. So you're not in the quantum mechanics states collapsing. The actual quantum mechanical state is there, and the electron is this large object, and it has to be a large object because you have to integrate it. So it all came to me. So that's a crucial transition to quantum mechanics. And I don't know how we do it, educate people nowadays, because we have the still two meatballs at a barbecue idea of quantum mechanics, and then the supercomputer view of quantum mechanics together. I'm very fortunate for that. So hopefully you're transitioning here. So at this stage, I'm about to just getting married, have some friends over, and these friends who know me, I said, oh look, I've discovered such and such, such and such, and they've said, you know what, Hill, we believe you, and if you can get a company together, we'll get some Chinese investment money for you. And indeed, I got the company together, got the patent together, got some Chinese investment money. That is the idea that, as best as I could tell at this stage, I had a fantastic tunable laser. And I still do. And eventually, to steal some thunder, it was experiments in Moscow State University in 91, which showed some promise. So I was going off to Canada, and I began to crack the laser dynamics of F2 lasers. It's sort of what's going on. An F2 is two fluorine lasers, and this particular laser is one of these cooperative stimulated emission lasers. So you have to throw your reliances on mirrors out and start. I wrote a paper on that. And it's at this stage that I began to actually figure out the actual molecular dynamics of how you can make a helium-2 plus flash lamp, and why it's so good. And here's a bit of the story. So all of science, you're taught of temperature. Temperature's the temperature of your water, your gas, your thermometer, your beaker is all the same. But this is not true for when you suddenly dump in your energy. So if you suddenly dump in your energy, the energy will go at the point of greatest conduction. So I don't know how to put it. Say if you're holding a metal fork and you suddenly put it in a flame, you'll feel the heat through the metal fork first. So in helium, your helium flash lamps, the big flash goes in really quickly, heats up all the creates heaps and heaps of ions, and then The next thing on is these ions have huge cross sections, so metastable helium and excited helium will appear. So if your helium was a meatball, it would suddenly appear the size of a basketball once it was hit. So you get a helium and you hit it, it suddenly increases in size. Let's see, a plane going above. Thing is that you've got this thing called recombinative cooling. So the recombination, the greater the amount of charge to start off with, the faster it recombines. Like it's insane, up I think up to the 6 or 7.5 power of your charge. So this is like if you double the charge density, and by virtue of lightning bolts, this is the charge density just goes up and up. So if you double the current, you more than double the charge density, because you've got the double the current plus the magnetic field, which is squeezing it in. It's this lightning bolt phenomenon. But then if you double the current, the recombination rate goes up. So this is a charge plus an electron goes back to something approaching a neutral state. It goes up phenomenally high because it's a multi-body transition, so your transition rate, your recombination rate, goes up by thousands. So what happens is that all your temperatures are all over the place, because everything's happening so quickly. The energy leap paths don't have a chance to actually equilibrate, so you can have a very high electron temperature, and then that high electron temperature can go to another temperature, and so we have this phenomena here, which is took a bit to examine, that you've got very hot gas, you're getting these very short space of time production of a helium ion and helium metastable coming together, forming a brief molecule at this high temperature, and next time it gets hit by another helium atom, it's enough to break that apart. So it forms very quickly, but it's very unstable. But here's the rub, that when an electron comes along, bonds with it, and it says, yippee, I can radiate a photon. And so you've got this called recombinative robivoronic cooling. And so in this high temperature arc, you have this cooling mechanism, because it's recombination, it's a cooling mechanism, and you actually cool your helium dimers down to, look, I was really getting down to a couple of degrees Kelvin. So I was getting a spectrum out of there. If you really choked it, you could get a high temperature spectrum with two energy levels. But I was getting really pretty well exclusive occupancy of the ground state. So you've got energy levels in this little cup, which is one and a bit EV up. So you can actually produce it, and then recombination drives it down. And this is coming up from people saying, hang on, I'm looking at vibronic energy levels, and at a certain conditions, they just disappear. And how they disappear is this thing. So your electrons coming in, you flash, it creates, and it starts to cool and forms these super molecules. And so that's rovibronic cooling. Again, just the tenacity of that there. And I have to sort of thank a cast of thousands of people that I'm speaking to, giving it along. So we have the introduction, the discovery by sort of a young Aussie man. I'm an old man now. A young Aussie man who's stuck with this fairly simple thing and actually just followed it through with supercomputers, and eventually cracked the mystery at the end of the day of how you can actually produce this molecule, which is really almost unproducible. How it's almost unthinkable how you can produce a molecule in a 10,000 degree arc. Everything is ripped apart, you know, seriously ripped apart. It's 10,000 degree arc, but it's been, when it's switched off, it freezes the molecules into the process, and you see this beautiful glow. So if you want to do this, and you've got a spectrometer, just put in some helium, reasonably great amount of helium, and just a high voltage, and let it spark, and you'll be able to see this beautiful rainbow effect. You can basically do it on any device. I have a laser, I have eczema lasers, and just for nostalgic purposes, I just flush it with helium and run it with just pure helium, reasonably high. Just run it through. You'll see this, and if you've got your electrodes aren't all that good and they're snaking, producing discharges, you will see this spectra very quickly. It's a very sort of one of the most basic spectra. Continuum spectra to see, and it's given a whole lot of insight into other molecular physics area. So the idea of this podcast for me is a bit more training in terms of binding a physics story with a personal story and trying to get it across, and perhaps Nia's story have been told well, but Gliss have been told for the first time. The personal drama is something that doesn't correspond to most people's experience of life, having to actually struggle really hard to get across. And then on the other hand, the quantum physics is something which doesn't correspond to majority of people can have this system where they... no one asks, and so no one knows in quantum physics. So there are these two sort of untold stories, which hopefully I'm trying to get out in a podcast. So I apologize for this podcast in terms of quality of production. It's just off the top of my head, and just trying to exercise my ability to speak for this point in time. So in the meantime, please keep on doing science.